This is French Reno Diaries Uncensored, your no-fluff guide to renovating in France. I'm Sue.
I'm Rosie.
I'm Michaela.
And we all run trade-related businesses here in France with our husbands. Today, we're focusing on how to get the best out of your artisan and how to be a good customer.
We've had one recently that said, I ran the measurements and the costings through ChatGPT, so I just thought, no thanks.
Trust is built, I think, over time. It's not something that happens immediately, I don't think. But I think you can spot red flags.
We do have some clients, and I understand their point of view. They've got maison secondaires and they want to come out for the summer and enjoy it. But it doesn't mean to say that you can make us like work through the night and the weekends just so you can come out and have a 2-week holiday.
Let's get to it. So today's topic, we're hitting on trust, how to get the best out of your artisan and how to be a good customer. So
yeah, hot topic today.
It is, definitely. So why trust matters so much in renovations and building projects, I think it's really important. And also because we're coming from a trade perspective and also a customer's perspective from renovating our own houses, we can kind of give advice on kind of both sides. And we've also asked a couple of questions in some Facebook groups, so we'll touch on them later.
Oh, that'll be interesting to hear.
Yeah, so ladies, what do we actually mean by trust? Does anyone want to kick us off?
I'd like to, if I may. Trust, because this is something that I cover a lot between tradies and mentoring and marketing, is a really important aspect, and it's a two-way relationship between the client and the trade. And I kind of created a bit of a couple of liners. Trust between the trade and the client is when both parties treat the relationship as a professional collaboration based on mutual respect, clear boundaries, open communication, and a shared goal of quality workmanship.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. How about you, Rosie? What do you think?
I would agree 100% with that. I think when you're in the trade and you meet clients, especially in France, when you meet expat clients who speak the same language as you, there is an inevitability that at some point you might feel like you're friendly. You know, you've become friends, like it's stepped over that professional kind of boundary. And I have to say, it's really like, no, it's a no-no for me. We've done it, we've been there, and we try to be a little bit more, we step back from that now. But it was quite difficult to do that for a while. But I just don't think it works. It needs to always remain professional between you and the client, and you need to set your boundaries as the client does, you know. But that's the one thing that I'd point out about trust, and I think that helps the trust between you. If the client knows what they're getting from you and who you are, and you're a company, you're not their friend, then that's clearer for them and it's clearer for you as well between the client. But it's not always easy.
No.
So relationship is everything, but keep it professional.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean,
agree.
Scott's of the same kind of thinking. It's a professional relationship and that's it. In the UK, there used to be kind of, friends going, friends rates, can you do it for this? He's always gone,
yeah,
no. It's either,
yeah,
that's it and that's it kind of thing. We've got customers that keep coming back. So he'll go the extra mile for them because they're returning clients and things like that. But it's still a professional relationship. It's a friendly, it's a nice relationship, but it's a professional one at the end of the day. They're paying him to do a job for them and there's certain expectations and things like that. So, and I think trust is something that's built upon. It's not instant.
No.
Yes, that's a good point, actually.
And when you touch on like the friend thing, going back to meeting people down the bar and meeting people down the pub, I think we've touched on this before, people only recommending their friends within their deep friendship circle. I think instinct and gut instinct is a good thing. And if you've got a good rapport with the company that you're employing, I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, I think you should always try and employ somebody who's probably not your friend in that situation, because I mean, I've known so many people over the years in the UK as well. I mean, John's got a friend who's a carpenter in the UK, and I know on the odd occasion he's worked for friends, and it's just like the expectations are not the same.
No.
The expectations, particularly from the client in that aspect, they think you're going to do things that are out of that relationship of being professional, and then they get upset, and it's inevitable, I think, that it might fall apart a little bit. And I don't think you should risk that on renovation. You shouldn't risk your friendship.
No.
And you shouldn't really risk your renovation either, when it's, you know, you might say something that upsets your friend and then that breaks down the relationship, or you deem that they've done something, they're your friend and they've not done the renovation properly, and then you've got a problem with them. It's just the expectations are different. Yeah.
Totally agree.
Also, I mean, we have quite a few clients that have houses abroad, so they're not here on site all the time. How would you kind of advise a client that if they're not in France and they are relying on that trade or that company, what could you advise them to do to make sure that they're going to get the best out of their kind of artisan while they're not on site?
I think initially you've got to lay down your pitch right from the very beginning. From our perspective, we have clients that aren't always in France, so that from initial contact and the minute the devi is presented, it's got succinct, clear, this is what we're doing, this is what we're using, these are the payment terms, these are our terms and conditions. So everything is laid out quite clearly right from the outset so that they know what they're doing. Then whilst they're away, they're always given a Google Drive update. So before we send out the facture, I mean, I know you ladies, your work is going to be a lot longer, but from an electrical point of view, that could be 5 days' work, it could be 15. So after that point of time when the facture's ready to go out, Paul will upload the photographs to Google Drive and we go, here is visual evidence, so that before you pay, if you have any questions, there's videos, there's photographs, all sorts of things, so that they know that in that 3 weeks, Paul's done exactly what he said he's done on the devi, because they're not there to sign the equivalent of the reception de travaux, so that they've got trust and confidence that the work's been done and that they can pay.
Yeah, we do a similar thing, actually. When we've got clients, we'll do updates. I'll do updates on email, whether it's weekly, whether it's bi-weekly, when there's something to show, and give them photographs. And like you say, if there's interim payments due, they'll get photographs to show what's been done and things like that. What about you, Rosie?
Yeah, we do exactly the same. It's all about communication, isn't it? Yeah. It's all about keeping the client updated. And even if they send an email which seems like a non-question to you, or like you've seen it and you don't respond immediately, I always try and respond in a good time, so I'm not leaving the client lingering too long, even if it's something you think you've already responded to. And if I can't respond at that moment, then I will just send them an email saying, I can't respond at this moment, but I will deal with this on Monday when I'm back in the office, or just keeping them up to date. Because I feel like a lot of things go wrong when you just don't respond to somebody. And I understand a lot of artisans who are so, so busy on site, they let a lot slip and go by. And I don't think really that's their fault. They've just not got all the time in the world to respond to every single client inquiry that they should do. And if they've not got someone like, you know, us dealing with that side of things, and it must be really hard. But I do think clients sometimes, if they don't get a response to their questions, the trust starts to break down a little bit, because they're like, why haven't they responded? Then if they're not on site and they're in a different country, they're back in the UK and things are happening and they've not had a response within like 3 or 4 days, then they'll start to get worried, and then it starts to get difficult to pull it back from that moment. Once it's gone down that path, it's harder for you as an artisan or a company to get it back to where it was. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's that phrase, isn't there, that it can take so many years to build trust, but literally seconds for it to be just gone.
Yes, definitely.
And as you say, difficult to pull back. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember not long ago, Michaela, you did a questionnaire, didn't you, with Artisan Central on what homeowners expect from their trade and what their biggest kind of thing was. And it was communication, wasn't it? It came out that...
Yeah, the top three things were reliability and punctuality. timely communication and honesty and integrity. Yeah.
That makes sense because, I mean, I think we've all been there, and this is one of the gripes that I see with a lot of clients is they don't understand why when an artisan starts a job, some people don't understand that an artisan has a schedule and they're not just running one job invariably, they're running two or three in tandem. And also there are subcontractors that come in from time to time. If you're a main contractor, then you have to wait for the plumber to come in or the electrician. So when they're doing their thing, you can't be doing your thing sometimes. Mm. So you go off site and you go to a different site. And just keeping the client updated on those things, I find helps. Even if they've not even asked us to, I try and say, look, we're not going to be there next week on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, because we're actually on a different work site, but we will be back hopefully that week when the electrician's done his thing. So it's just keeping on top of those things. It takes work, but I think that is something that really helps the trust between you and the client. Because then they don't have anything to complain about. Like, you didn't tell me you weren't going to be there. My neighbour was round and said that you weren't there on that day. Mm. You've already preempted it. And I think that...
Do you not find that? I mean, we only do fixed price jobs. We don't do day rate jobs. So do you find that clients would be more inclined to not like that? What, you know, same as you, you do fixed. So if you're not on site, it doesn't matter kind of thing. The job's still the job, whether it takes however long it takes. Whereas if somebody's at a day rate, I imagine homeowners are a little bit more time tracking them.
Yes.
Which could break trust quite quickly, I imagine, if they're not on site.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, I have got a story about that, about a French lady that I know locally who has used an artisan recently and unfortunately is British, but been in France a long, long time. And he's quite well known as a trade in this part of the world. I've heard of him, I've met him a few times. I know other people who have had work done by him. I don't think he's insured, but that's another story. But I saw her the other day and I said to her, how are you? And she said, not very well. And she said, you know, I won't say his name. She said, he came round to do some work on an apartment that I've just bought, the electrics, and he's just made an absolute mess of it. She said, he asked for €25 an hour. He's working by the hour. And he asked me to pay up front. So I was a little bit like, if he's not giving you a devy, how did he know how much to ask you for up front? How did he know how many hours if he's not worked it out? And she said, yeah, I did think that, but I gave him a chunk up front for him to start. No devy, no insurance. He started. And she said he was charging her because she knows people locally. She lives in the centre of town. There's a tabac next door. So she said he was going in the morning and he was going in about 10 a.m. But he was telling her he was going in at 8 a.m. because she was going off to work. And the people in the tabac were like, oh, no, he was in here. He only arrived at like 10 a.m., had a coffee, had a cigarette, and then he went up to your place. So he charged her from 8 a.m., and then he charged her for his lunchtime. So he'd taken an hour for lunch. And then she said, one day she came back and he said, oh, I've done 6 hours today. And she looked around and she said, I'm sorry, but what have you done in 6 hours? Can you just tell me? And he went, you don't understand how difficult electrics are. I have to think a lot of the time. I had to think about how I was going to do it. Literally, she told me this. And I was like, oh, so you were paying him to think? She said, yeah, I was paying him to think. So, there we go. So, yes, I think it's justified some of the time from the client's point of view that they should be on top of their artisan and making sure that they're not taking the you-know-what.
But don't you find that, I mean, you certainly see it, that businesses that are bona fide and take it seriously, that take their values about what they're about personally and professionally and invest them into their business so that you've got proper paperwork, you've got insurance. I mean, then the client gets that, and then you've got a tranche of people. I looked under the term charismatic earlier on. You've got people going back to what you said earlier on, you're schmoozing in the bar, yeah, giving it all that, could buy you a drink, that charisma. But charisma doesn't make you the right person, the right fit for the job.
That's a friend. Yeah. That's the distinction. Yeah.
But also a lot of trades, again, I see it, are motivated by the money. Again, if you're a proper business that's got values, for us, it's about the value of the client.
Yes, the value that we give it's to your the reputation client. As well. You're putting
reputation,
on the line.
Yes, yeah.
So I think also it's like there's a more black and white thing for me about it, in the fact that if you're running a business and you know you might have employees as well, or if you're running a good business, then you have a deadline for yourself because you need to turn over a certain amount of money for your end of year accounts because you've already. Yep. Like predicted that, you know, sometimes almost for the year, from your last end of year accounts, your last BLON, you see what the chiffre d'affaires was and what your benefice was or your profit. And then you want to do the same for the next year. So then you almost hit the ground running after your last BLON to achieve the same in the next 12 months. So if you're running a kosher business, then you're in that kind of mindset. We have to be on and off this site by that time to get onto the next job, to earn the money, to be able to pay the wages for everybody else and have a bit over to pay ourselves and, you know, a bit of profit. So that's the kind of black and white thing for me that's just like, it doesn't need explaining that. It's like, of course, we're going to be like off site as finished as quickly as we can because we've got to pay wages.
So what do good clients do differently to bad clients on your perspective from a trade side? How can somebody be a good customer? And what makes a project easy, enjoyable? All of those things, you know what I mean? What kind of things can you advise a homeowner to make them a good client as well?
So we've had both bad and good.
we've had more often very good clients. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of that, but we've nipped it in the bud right from the very beginning. Last year, when Paul was on his Erector Tavai, we'd collected a deposit from somebody for a rewire. And during his Erector Tavai, he received an email that called Paul a gypsy.
Oh, what? Well, that's...
So being the front end of the business and the back end, I thought, no, I'm not having that. So I looked at all the emails. He was trying to get hold of Paul to determine when he could bring his furniture over. We'd already given him an email to say, thank you for the payment, that the FDA being paid, the parts being ordered, Paul's scheduled to go in on X, Y, and Z. So that was after the Erector Tavai, that his was going to be the first job. But during that 6-week period, he had tried to phone to find out when he could bring his furniture over and then sent us an email saying, I'm beginning to lose trust in you. You're acting like a gypsy.
That's the client that's broken down the trust right there and then. How can you go back from that?
Yeah, well, we did. We said, okay. Well,
you have to finish the job, obviously, but that
is a classic example. Well, we didn't start it.
Right, okay.
At that point, we didn't know if Paul was going to be going back to start the job because he had yet to have his consultant review to say, your hernia's okay, you can go back on site. So I kind of preempted it and said, thanks for your email. Bit concerned about
your language.
The tone of, yeah. We would be mortified. Paul would be mortified if he couldn't start the job on the date that we've already confirmed to you. So at this point in time, it might be wise if we give you your deposit back so that you can find another electrician to do the job that you want done. The job's still not been done, and that's 9 months ago. So he's not... But I just thought, you've broken that trust as a client. You've done that.
Unfortunately, I think that's just someone who's not very nice.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I think 100% of the time our clients have been nice. They've been nice people. I won't go into that. But I think with the best of intentions, we all go into it wanting something positive to come out of it. For me, that's not a very nice person at the base because that's almost verging on xenophobic language that he was using there. And I don't agree with that one iota, and I would do the same as you. I wouldn't want to work for someone like that. But when I say we've had bad clients, I wouldn't say they're not bad people. I think invariably they're people who have been fed some sort of like, not lie, but playbook of how to deal with an artisan, and you have to be in control of your artisan, or don't let them wipe the floor with you, or something like that. So they go into it with a bit of a mindset that's like, I am the boss. So they try and micromanage quite a lot, and they try and like check up on you, and then they try and like check your work or something. Like, we've had people like measuring meter squareages of plasterboarding to check that we've put the correct meter squareage on a devis, not knowing how we calculate it, because we have tolerance built in as well. Also, there's insulation behind plasterboarding, which is tied into the, you know, if you have like 145 mil Rockwool insulation with rails and plasterboard, it's tied into an ouvrage that we cost on. So they don't even know how we've costed, but they just measure the meter squareage. Like, by the millimeter we've had it, people in their properties measure it. Oh, that's like 3 centimeters out, or that's half a meter, so we want half a meter back. Like, we're not paying for half a meter on that wall. Yeah, we've had that. And I just think it's because they've been fed this kind of narrative from other people that might have had bad experiences, or maybe they've had bad experiences in the past, and they don't want to be hoodwinked. And that's something that does break down trust. Because
how do you manage that though, Rosie?
In that instance, it was the first time that happened to us, and it hasn't happened again, fortunately. That was just one specific thing that this client did. And it was because I think it came out of the fact that it was during COVID when we started the job. So a lot of delays came about on that job. So they started to get angsty that they wanted to come and stay in their house for summer, and these things might not be completed by then. But there were so many delays with materials and other like subcontractors in that time frame that we were the main contractor. So we were getting all the aggro from this client. Why are you not pushing? Why are you not getting this? You know, and it wasn't easy. We all know that. Wasn't a case of shouting at someone down the phone, screaming at them to come for this client, because otherwise, you know, this client's going to give you. It doesn't work like that. So trying to explain those things, trying to write it down in an email concisely, calmly. But I do find that once it's gone to that, it's very difficult to pull it back, because it almost becomes a battle of wills then as well. It's like, who's got the power? Who's got the, you know, who's in charge here? You know, and I'm not saying that we as the main contractor are in charge of the client, but we should be in control of the chantier, not the client, because the client doesn't have the experience to run the job. They don't know what they should be looking for. They don't know how it works behind the scenes. They don't know what all the myriad of problems you can have on a job, that you're not going to sit there every day and write a 3-page email of like, well, today we had to wait 4 hours for the plumber to turn up when he didn't on time. And then when we opened up this wall, then we found this. And then we had to go to the builder's yard and we couldn't find everything that we needed. So then we had to go to another builder's yard. You're not going to tell your life story to the client every day of all the things that are going on, but all those things are going on. And all those things are the things that put jobs behind and give you trouble in your day that you hide from the client because you don't want to give them the stress. Yes. And I think that's what clients don't understand a lot of the time. We're taking on the stress of the job, trying to get it done in time. And then the bad ones, in inverted commas, tend to give more stress because they don't know all those things. So it's like a no-win situation.
From our perspective, we've been very lucky. But coming back to what you said, Michaela, it's about transparency from the beginning. And I'm kind of the communication, the same as kind of you guys are for your businesses. And from the off, I am, if we get an inquiry, you can kind of fish out from our perspective on whether they're going to be a good client or not. We've been really, really lucky, and I can actually say, yeah, pretty much 100%. We've had no issues with clients paying. We've had no issues. We've been very, very lucky, because if they start being particular at the initial stage, Scott will just not work for them. So, for example, if there's red flags coming up from certain, we put a devi out and we got questioned. He'd worked out the per hour rate from our labour, because we just do a fixed price job. We don't do a per hour. We just do the labour. Sometimes it'll have days on, sometimes it won't. But invariably, it's however many people are on site, and we'll put a rough estimation. Scott will never say it's going to take 5 days. We always put...
No, John won't.
We'll put 5 days labour on, or he'll always put five... Yeah, say it's 5 days labour and they finish in four. You're still paying this because it's a fixed price job. It's not dependent on...
Yes.
On, and if it goes over to 6 days, it's still the same amount. So we've had clients that questioned that in the off and in the... and basically we just say, thank you, no thank you. You need to find somebody else. We're not the right fit for you.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because it's almost like a Scott gives a best case scenario for the client, but he has to stick to that. But he knows at the back, he also has to like factor in, and so does John and probably Paul as well, Michaela, that maybe this job will have some difficulties. So they have been factored in to a certain extent, and that's why you're giving that price, because that's clever. Yeah. You know, that's how you should run a business. You're anticipating things. The experience tells you that not every job goes swimmingly. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a lot of demolition to do, you could uncover things during it. So you've factored it into that costing. So it's up to the client whether or not, I suppose, at the end of the day, they agree to that. Yep. That's their prerogative. I do suspect that those kind of clients who won't will find themselves in difficulty with an artisan who's not factored in things properly, or want a day rate, and then you pay them for a lot more days than you would have done for a normal devi from a, you know, the likes of us.
But, I mean, also, I think,
you know, it seems cheap in the beginning.
I think from both perspectives, when Scott goes, because he obviously goes and does all the meetings, initial meetings, he's a really, really good judge of character. And he will inevitably come back and go, we're not going to hear anything from them. I says, well, let's do the quote. And 9 times out of 10, he is right. So he gets a feeling himself. So, and I think from a homeowner's point of view, it works both ways. So if you go in and you get a good rapport with that, I'm not saying do the car salesman spiel, but the company's transparent, they're professional. You get a good rapport with the artisan that comes round. There's only so much you can do. And then trust is built, I think, over time. And it's not something that happens immediately, I don't think. But I think you can spot red flags. I think you can spot certain things.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the trust can't be the fact that you like them. Like, if from a client's point of view, the trust doesn't come from, and you shouldn't do this, I like this person. As we said before, I met them in the pub, they seem great, I get on with them. That's not trust. That's just you like somebody. Yep. And then beyond that, if you get a devi, or you meet a company and they give you the correct devi with all the right things on it, and you've checked them, they've got their insurances, they've got the SIRET number, they give you a professional looking devi, they've outlined it correctly, then I think that's the first step to trust. Because the company has shown you as the client that they respect you enough to give you all these things that are obligatory and mandatory and official and professional. And then you as a client can recognize that, well, this is a good company, they're running correctly. And then that's where the trust starts from. And then beyond that, you as the artisan or company has to make sure that you run the job correctly and you do the best that you can for that client. Then all that we've just spoken about comes into play, the communication, the updates.
To tail that, Rosie, which leads nicely on to what I want to add on, is that trust then is built with your reputation brand management. For instance, after every job, because we do a number of jobs throughout the year, your jobs take a longer time. So we probably do a lot more in a shorter space of time. So after every job's done, I send out a review form to each customer to say, how did Paul do? You know, every single one has come back as a 5-star. So when I use that as marketing gold, it tails the stuff that the marketing that goes out, the in-house paperwork that goes out that builds that trust to the point where that customer then is happy to put it in a testimonial. So you can see the complete journey of us as a business, which in turn helps other people make a better buying decision. So, you know, when people say, we've heard a lot about you, or you're talked about in a good positive way in the community, you know that your brand ambassadors on the front line, as we like to say, are talking about you in a positive way that comes back to you as a business. So for me, it's a full circle.
Yeah, it's end to end. And yeah, I think we maybe need to catch up a little bit on our marketing in that respect, like to chase every client at the end of the job. We don't tend to like chase for testimonials. We're just onto the next job and like preparing that. And it takes a lot, like you say, because you've got so much to prepare that it's not often that I remember to do that. But I can see that could like be the first portal of trust as well, that you can see other people trusted you and they've given you 5 stars. So you're more inclined to trust. Yeah.
Something that you regularly see, that somebody that's got prepared to put their digital footprint out there, when we're in competition or have to compete with MEs that can price per hour, not include the materials and do a number of other things to kind of win the job, we have to use what we've got to its best ability in order to kind of stay competitive within the market. So and for us, it's, you know, doing what we say, following it through with the testimonial, so that the next person can come along and go, yeah, like that. Yeah.
I'm going to bring this back on us, actually, and I'm going to ask a question. Where do you think trades get it wrong sometimes? Ooh. I mean, nobody's perfect.
Crap paperwork. I
that, you sound very adamant about that, because
absolutely, because I see a lot of people, or hear from a lot of people, that devies are not correct. They don't have the legals. Some put TVA when they're not even registered to be charging TVA. Don't have the decennial and details on. No clear payment terms. I know one chap who his devy is just an email.
Oh.
It's just the email. And then wonders why, you know, he doesn't get the work. Now, we all know that e-invoicing is coming into fashion this year. Then there will be a tranche of businesses, trades, that are nowhere near ready.
No.
And when you're still putting your devy on a Word document or handwritten, you know, for me, it's about crap paperwork. We've all been doing this long enough to know that it goes a long way to kind of creating trust between the client and the trade. Crap paperwork and sketchy contact details.
Yeah, that's a massive red flag, isn't it? If they can't even provide a proper quote for you, a proper written quote. If they can't do that, then and I know. To be fair, if it was Scott doing it and he didn't have me doing the office side of things, then that side of things would be lacking. I'm going to be honest, because he's a tradesperson. His skill is in his trade. He's not very good. He's not very good at emails. He's not very good at, I mean, I show him our software that we use and it's just, he wouldn't be able to do it. So yeah, I kind of get the ones that are kind of self-employed and doing it on the, they don't, maybe don't have somebody in the background doing that side of things for them.
Yeah.
However, they can produce a devy. Yeah.
Yeah. Running the business is an integral part of being in business. There are myriads of people that are great on the job, the tools, the skills, they're fabulous, but are often let themselves down because of the administrative side. But the two run side by side. So whilst you're crap at it, there are ways and means of kind of improving it or outsourcing it so that you can get
better. There's lots of software out there that's really easy to manage. You don't have to be doing Excel spreadsheets or Word documents. It's there.
No.
Free as well.
To be honest, now, even our accountants changed to a new logiciel, a new software that shows everything. I mean, we can go on it as well, and it shows kind of like month on month where we are. And that's one thing that the accountant gives us. And then we can actually take pictures of like all our receipts. We can just upload it instantly. onto their account package, and they see it instantly. Yeah, it gives us like pie charts and things. Yeah, you know, it's like it's really sophisticated. And then on our side, we use OBAT for factures and invoices. And that's kind of like, it does a little bit of what Penny Lane does that the architect has, the accountant has. But it makes it really simple for us to do devis and factures because it has a bibliotheque or a library. So we just like save all our, you know, ouvrages in there or, you know, what do you call it in English? Jobs.
Projects, yeah. Mm.
Projects, yeah. And then you can reaccess them so you're consistent with your price. And also it has a link to the national prices of every single material. Like it has a link to plasterboard in how much it costs as an average all over the country. So we have access to all those things from the software that we use. I have to say, though, I think Sue and I are in a different position, perhaps, where it's very myriad what we do in our companies. So there's no way that one person could run a company and do everything that our companies do. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it has to have someone like us in it. And that's how we've got an office and we've got like an admin team and and then we've got the guys on site. That's the nature of the business that we run. So it has to be like that.
Yep.
And also we're RGE registered, so you get audited. And the first thing when you fill in the dossier that's about 300 pages long to Calibat, you have to give examples of your devis and factures so they can check that you are putting the right things on there and that every single line makes sense. And you have to like put the R value of the insulation on there so that they know that you're giving the customer the right information. So yeah, you know, single sole traders might not do that and might not know everything that we do because of the nature of our businesses.
Yeah.
We've been forced to do it. We're forced to comply to these things. Mm. It's advantageous.
So what do you do in a situation where something's gone wrong and you've got to tell the client? I mean, for us, if something's gone wrong, we own it. We own it massively. I mean, there was a time when, and actually it cost us €1,000. It was my fault. We were so busy, and usually when we're ordering glass for windows and things, I look over it and then Scott will scan it as well. And I missed something on it, and we ended up getting this. It was too thick, and I thought at the time, the prices have gone up, and then it never even twigs. So we get this glass. I think we've still got it, €1,000 worth of glass. And Scott realized, he's like, I can't fit this. This is too thick. It doesn't go in the window, the doors that he was making. It's too thick. And he was like, Suze, what did you order? So obviously that meant that the job slowed. Client wasn't overly happy. I mean, it could come across on email listing, but all I could do, I says, what do I do? And he says, just own it. Just tell them what we've done. We've made a massive mistake, ordered the wrong glass. We've got to order it again. It's going to delay the job. There's no point fluffing about it. Just be honest.
I think,
and we had to own it.
I agree.
And that was it.
And it's not the client's fault, is it? So you just have to
apologise and say, look.
You know, not put the price up, just do it, you know, just take the cost, hit.
Yeah, it was my,
you know,
it was our mistake. So
apologise.
It's just the fact that it was another 4-week delay because we weren't going to get the glass.
Yeah. I think honesty is the best policy.
Yeah.
Mm. And try your best to, I suppose always try your best to solve every problem that you encounter to the best of your ability. I don't think the client needs to know everything.
No.
Because some things could just set them off, and we all know that.
Yeah, you've got to be quite diplomatic about what you
say. Sorry, people out there. There are some things there are some things that we do hide, I have to say, because you know that you can solve them, and you do. And it's a bit like, if you tell people everything that's going on, they'd just be like tearing the hair out or like.
Well, that's what they're paying you for, isn't it? Mm. You know, years of experience, years of training, years of knowledge, you know, using the best equipment and tools and machinery that you've got in order to get that job done.
Mm. Yeah. And we're there to problem solve if anything happens.
Yeah. I mean, times Paul comes home and says, it was a bit of a tricky one today because, you know, I can see him. over tea and toast in the morning, he's mulling over something, and it's either FPL, Fantasy Football League, or he's mulling over, you know, a part of the job that's going to be needing some focus. So he's doing that in his own time. The client's not paying for the thinking time. He's thinking before he gets to the job. But
yeah,
a lot of the client interaction, because if somebody phones after he's or he's on his way home, and I just think, oh God, what's he done? What's he done? It'll be no. He's left his drill in the loft, or his screwdriver sets in the sous-sol. Do you know what I mean? So it, more often than not, it's somebody saying he's left an important part of his toolkit here. Can you, you know, can I catch him before he gets home so he can come back and get it? So yeah, that, a lot of the time it's a customer phoning up saying he's left some tools on site. And when I talk to other trades, they go, it's a man thing. We all do it. We all leave tools somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of, the bane of John's life, trying to remember between work sites where that is. Where did we last use that scaffolding? And, oh, maybe we should go and collect it. Sometimes it is a bit like that. I know that sounds quite bad, but we don't leave it for months and months. But it is kind of like you move on to the next job and it's like, oh, now we've got to go back there to take that bit down so we can transport it over there. And, yeah, so it's a mental gymnastics, I think.
Clients don't need to know any of that because they're not interested.
No,
they're not interested.
But they should. I mean, we're here and we're talking about it, so maybe we should like just say these things happen, and if you can appreciate that as a client, if you're listening to this and you could just take that on board next time you employ an artisan or a trade, and maybe give them a little bit of slack, not too much, but, you know, understand they're human as everybody else is, trying to do the very best that they can. And, not everyone's out to
rip you off.
Not everyone's out to get you.
Or do a bad job. They're not. I mean, I would say yes, they do happen, and you're only going to hear about the bad things. Usually on Facebook's group, people are you know what I mean? They're more inclined to say something that's gone wrong than something that's gone really, really well. Going on to Facebook, we added a question, didn't we? So the question was, how do you find tradespeople you can trust? What's your top tip for getting great results? And any memorable stories, good or bad? And like I say, I'm going back to the bad. We've had a few stories that they're very quick to share the bad experience.
Yeah, of course. Unfortunately, they stick in people's minds more than the good.
Yes, yeah.
So Amanda put quite a big comment on, and one of the things that I think was quite important, she said, don't limit yourself by insisting on English language, although sometimes that's easier said than done. Get local advice and try and employ the best, whatever the nationality, whether they're French, whether they're Belgian, whether they're English, whatever. It's not about the nationality, it's about how good they are as an artisan. So I think that's a really good point.
Yes,
that's a
absolutely.
Really, really good point.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there is something to be said. Invariably, French artisans are more inclined to know the rules, regulations, paperwork more instinctively. Because invariably, I think to be a trade in France, you've gone through some education, you've gone through an apprenticeship, or you've nowadays, I think, maybe some of the old school artisans, not so much. But I think there is that pull. But that's to say there are a lot of great Brit trades out there, and like us, like our companies who do follow the rules, and we make sure that we do know all that as well. So
there's one point that I don't agree with. From our perspective, I'll see how you feel on this. She said, always pay in installments, which is fine. I agree. Obviously, we set our payment conditions on the job. It's specific to that job. Yeah. It's not a set thing. It's specific to the job. So if Scott's making something, we'll ask for 50% upfront, because most of the work is done in the workshop. So we will ask for a big chunk upfront. If we're buying, say we're doing supply and install, we'll ask for almost 80% before he gets on site to install, because...
Gosh, will you?
We ask for 100. Yeah. We ask for 100%.
Yeah. So because it will be say we're ordering some windows, because he's actually stopped making them now. We're using a supplier. just because for cost of, to be competitive, unless somebody's got something really specific that they need making bespoke, the market's so competitive, we've ended up finding a really, really good supplier for wooden windows, and we supply and install. So if we're doing that, we will ask for 75% to 80%. They'll pay the deposit, so that's paid. But before Scott gets on site, 80% has been paid, because the rest of it's labour fitting.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So the standard, is it standard 30, and then the remainder just before you start the job?
Yeah. So it just depends on the job.
Yeah, so up to the 80.
But she's put on this, which I do not agree with at all. Always paying, fair enough, always paying instalments with the final 40% after snagging's been done.
Well, no. You can't hold back 40% from a company. I mean, imagine if someone said, I'm just holding back 40% of your wages until the end of the month,
completed
or the
that
end
report.
Of next month for this month. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to like check up on your work and see if you completed what I asked you to do. It doesn't work like that,
does
it?
That's coming back to trust again, isn't it?
What if you've got a customer that's not in France?
What if they don't pay that 40%?
You know, I'm over. Yeah.
So that's something that I don't particularly agree with.
That's not a legal standpoint for a client to... They're not in the right when they're doing that. That is a bad client, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah.
If you do that. Because that's destroying... That's potentially you actively destroying someone's business.
Yeah. We've never had a client dictate payment terms. Yeah. Because we're transparent in the beginning. You pay this, this, this and this. And we've never had anybody question the terms.
We usually say 5%.
We kind of 10.
We can retain 5%.
We probably say 10. Depends on the job.
Yeah. The unfortunate thing sometimes for us is that we start a job and then the nature of the work just grows and grows and grows. So then the client decides they want something else doing and something else doing and something else doing. So it becomes a little bit difficult to manage in that respect. Like, we need to constantly adapt sometimes our payment plans, which takes a lot of admin.
Yeah.
So there's that going on behind the scenes. We come up with the payment plan, and then it's like, but that's changed now because now the job's grown by 30%. So now we need another, it's difficult.
Yeah. Obviously, she said what we say all along, check the Cirrus, check the Decinel, which is great. Personal recommendations. Yeah, that's great. And that the dev is exactly what you're getting. Obviously, sometimes, like you've just said, things change, but then you have to set an avenant do another devy or whatever. But yeah, just check that everything's on there.
Yeah.
I mean, because invariably, going back to what Rosie's just said, clients will add on. And Paul will see that in electrics, it will be a case of, oh, whilst you're here...
Can you just...
And he's yes. So he'll be very strict and say, no, you've signed the devy that says I'm doing X, Y and Z. So anything on top, if it's part and parcel of what needs to be done there and then it's always... an addition that will be added onto the facture. But if it's a new set of work, it will be, no, that's another devy and another, time factored into the calendar.
Yeah, that's the right way to do it. Do a completely new devy. Sometimes we have to do avenants though, because it's something that's attached to what we've already started.
Yes.
So that's when it becomes
totally
a little bit difficult.
Yeah.
It's frustrating. And we do try to tell the client, please decide everything that you want to do in the beginning. And then we can have a smooth run on this job. But clients' prerogative, they think that they can change things a little bit into the into works. I don't know if we're ever gonna solve that problem, but tricky sometimes.
So to kind of finish this one off, what can we give our homeowners listening practical takeaways of being a good customer, really? So if you could give them one piece of advice that they should not forego, what would it be?
From an electrical point of view or trades that don't have multi-services like you two ladies, it's giving as much detail as possible. Instead of an inquiry that says, a ballpark figure of an electrical rewire, in order to help quantify where we take our business, it's about knowing where they are, which department code they're in, and whether we can get there, and the nature of the electrical work. We've had one recently that said, I ran the measurements and the costings through ChatGPT. So I just thought, no thanks. not the kind of client that we want when our cost comparison is by ChatGPT.
As if. I mean, the thing with ChatGPT is, and I think we've spoke about this before, is that you need to know everything, all the, you know, technical aspects of what you're asking ChatGPT to be able to make it work properly for you. So you need the experience of asking the question and then you'll get the right response. But if a client is just asking a random question without knowledge of how things work behind it, then
could be just any number,
it's not going to work, is it?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And also,
try not to change some things midway through a job. Try to make all the big decisions with your artisan, your trade at the beginning, plan it out so you don't swap and change during the job, because that is, it can be a catastrophe, you know, not just financially, but you're demanding a lot from your artisan. He's got to go away and rethink the costings. He's got to make sure he's keeping up with what he's charging you. That takes a lot of time out away from the work site. He's got to do that either in his own time or on a day when he should be working for you on site, because it's an important aspect for him to keep up with costings for you as the client and for him. So yeah, less changes, little changes, but not major changes.
Just to add on to my list, I'd just add one more, is that when a trade is on site using tools, just let them get on with their job in peace, instead of being, you know, somebody
hovering,
just kind of chin wagging, because some of the tools that trades use are flipping dangerous, you know. And while you're turning around going yeah, you know, and you're putting a respect the boundaries that whilst they're on site doing the job,
or if they're up a ladder.
I mean, somebody sent me, we asked the question from a trades perspective on Facebook, and somebody put, my work necessarily involves high powered machines and spinning blades. And he said his pet hate is catching a waving figure in my provisional vision, waving a bottle of water. So, you know, and coming up too close to them so that they swing by with a power machine that could potentially slice off a client's legs or an arm. So, yeah, just be mindful of that when they're focused and concentrating using dangerous machinery, to let them carry on doing what.
And also, if Scott's using anything, if he takes any big saws on site, he's got kind of mobile planers and things like that, invariably he'll have headphones in for the noise. And so many times, not when he's on site, but if he's in the workshop here, I've just opened the door and he's like, "Ooh, what?" You know what I mean? Because he's not expecting anybody to come through.
Yeah.
And he's
in the moment.
Yeah, he's pushing a piece of wood through a massive spinning blade and I'm like making him jump.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. That's definitely one.
So no major changes, no disrupting during works. Wait till break times to talk to your artisan.
Yeah. And preparation. Prep is really, really important. From the customer's perspective, like you were saying, know what you want. And also setting realistic expectations as well.
Yeah. You need to trust your artisan that is accounted for time and not start to push him to your time scale. We do have some clients, and I understand their point of view. They've got maison secondaires and they want to come out for the summer and enjoy it. But it doesn't mean to say that you can make us like work through the night and the weekends just so you can come out and have a 2-week holiday. I'm sorry, but you know, we've got our own lives to lead, that understanding.
We've had some clients that are second homes and they'll be traveling and they do give us a deadline date. Invariably, we don't kind of work to deadline dates, but if they've said it from the start and we can calendar that into our diary, Scott will work to a deadline.
I agree with that if it's said in the beginning,
to be done.
This is the deadline that we want, and then we can calculate it and say
possible.
Yes or no. But we've had clients that are like, you know, oh, we're thinking of coming next week, and you're like halfway through something. Yeah. Oh, we thought we'd just come out. Is it in a state where we can like stay there? And you're like, no.
Book a sheet down the road.
You feel like you've upset them, or you're like in control of their house. Like, no, you can't come to your house. We're, you know. It's not like that. It's just, it's disruptive. And you invariably, we'll go off-site.
Yeah.
We'll go off-site. If a client comes to stay, we'll go off-site somewhere else, because it's just, it starts to feel like then they're going to be asking loads of questions, they're going to ruin their own holiday as well, like asking the questions. They'll just focus on that. So we just say, well, we'll go off site then if you're going to come. But yeah, we're in at this stage. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely. Did you have any other trade perspective, Michaela?
Yeah, there was an interesting one. He FaceTimed me yesterday. It's not necessarily trade related, but it links into something that we're all probably quite familiar with. And he worked for Stuart Crystal in the UK.
I don't know who that is.
And spent a number of years in apprenticeship.
Should we know?
It's expensive crystal. Okay. It's expensive crystal. So he had an apprenticeship, and he said one time this woman came in dripping with Chanel, picking up something, purchasing something. But at the same time, she brought in a crystal that needed repairing. And she said, can you repair that for me? And he said, yes. So he took it away, repaired it, and said to her, that will be £3, please. And she said, but that took you 3 minutes to do. And he said, yes, I know. But that's 30 years of training and experience and £30,000 worth of expensive machinery to get that done for you in three minutes.
£3? She quibbled over £3. That sounds like that client we had who measured plasterboard.
It kind of made me...
Maybe it's the same people.
Yes. Not realising the value and the skill and the depth of knowledge that somebody puts to the job that means that it's done quicker, it's done in time. Not, you know, no mistakes are made that are glaringly obvious for a client to kind of look at something and go, oh God, that doesn't look right. So yeah, I see that a lot in my area where people go, but you can do that. Surely you can do that in half a day and expect it to be done in half a day. So yeah, and that was quite an interesting perspective. Couple of others. Clients who are disorganised and not ready for you to start on the agreed date.
Really?
Yeah, but Paul gets this when he turns up and he's got to move bedroom furniture, wardrobes.
Touching on that, Michaela, we've got that in our T's and C's that everything's got to be out of the way. It's got to have access to any furniture, anything. So if Scott's fitting a window and they've got like a bed in front of the window, or they've got, it's not his job to move it. That everything has to be, it's in our T's and C's that it all has to be out of the way.
Right.
That's wise. It sounds silly, but I am shocked at how many times we've encountered that situation where clients actually think that is your job to do. Mm. Like, oh, you're not going to move the furniture out of the way. Yeah. I'm in the UK. I can't do it. So I thought you'd do it for me. Yeah, so putting it in your
T's and C's. I mean, he will do it. I'm not saying it's a blanket. Yeah. He won't do it, but it is in the T's and C's that it.
Yeah, but I mean, without being asked is a bit...
Yeah. Yeah, if somebody says, can you just put this in there for me? And he has moved beds up when he's done a loft conversion. Can you just get the beds up so that we can, when we come, we've got the beds up? And he's like, yeah, I'll do that. And and you know what I mean? It's about client relationship as well.
Yeah.
So he will kind of, if it's a really good client, he will, and a repeat client, he will kind of, like I said before, go the extra mile a little bit if they need something before they come. He will, to a certain degree.
And also that ties into the trust, doesn't it? Mutual respect.
Yes.
The client just needs to ask you if you'll do that, you know, not assume that you do that. So that's something that a client could do from their point of view to enhance the trust aspect.
I think that's kind of the big thing, isn't it? I think everything is about mutual respect from the off.
Yeah.
Which is what we started with, wasn't it? Yeah.
Then we're done. So thank you for listening. If you like the show and you got something valuable out of it, please leave us a review. Your hosts have been Rosie Ellis, Michaela Wilkins and Sue Peek-Russell. French Renault Diaries Uncensored was produced and mixed by Katie Wright, and the music is by Grand Project.